What I was struggling with was when we were doing St. Archer, I was still a pro skateboarder, and my identity was still in that as well, right? And I didn't realize how much identity and then, you know, probably purpose on top of that, how much of that was wrapped into that career and what it was actually going to feel like when that career went away. And so in that moment, the only way I can explain it was like I felt completely lost.
Welcome to the Rich Drummers Report, where we talk real estate, business, and wealth building, all while keeping it real. No fluff, no BS. I hope that you enjoy the show. All right, guys, welcome to another episode of The Report. Today, we are back in the studio here in downtown San Diego, and we got a meetup here tonight, and we got a very special guest today. He was a professional skateboarder, one of the best to ever do it. Now he's retired, investing in commercial real estate. He's taking down big deals. He is the founder, co-founder of St. Archer Brewing Company. I got none other than Mikey Taylor. Mikey, welcome to the show,
Thanks
man.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, dude, I appreciate you coming down. Down from Thousand Oaks is where you live.
Right.
Excited to fucking dig into your story, man. There's so much to dig into, but what have you been up to these days, man?
Oh, life right now is our business, our company, my family. I have four kids now, so we have our hands full with that. And then I'm a city council member in Thousand Oaks as well. So that's like my, I don't know, side hustle.
When did you get into that?
I ran in this last election. So the November election is when I got voted in. And so it's been the, what is that, 6 months?
Dude, that's crazy.
Yeah.
What's that like being a city council member?
Different. It's different. It's different. If you're an entrepreneur and you're used to like the pace of business, especially if you're a smaller company, where you can come up with an idea and it's very much possible to get that idea into reality easily within a month, mm-hmm. right? Government doesn't work that way. Government's slow.
Especially out here in California.
Yes. So that I'm still adjusting to. It's just that the timeline is much more, you know, spread out. But it's new. So I do like that, you know, there's things I'm learning about it. And, you know, you have to deal with different personalities. And then I would say the cool part about it, you're constantly hearing from people in the community that you're doing life with. Mm-hmm. And that part's actually really cool.
And I can imagine from a community standpoint, there's a lot of people in the community that probably see you on the council and see you as one of the individuals they can actually relate to a little bit more versus the more traditional council members that are a little bit older and a little bit more, you know, suit oriented.
Right.
But what's that been like just kind of getting into, I mean, from a time standpoint, you're doing so much. That's got to pinch you a little bit, no?
Yes. So probably about 2 months ago, I came home and I just so happened to have a week where from the second I woke up until like I got home late at night, kids are asleep, wife's asleep, and it was every single night, right? And after that week, my wife looked at me and she's like, this is it. Do not do anything else. Like right now you are at max capacity. This is what we're doing. Let's let something get off your plate before you commit to anything else. So it was an adjustment for sure. You know, the commitment of something like city council, you usually have two meetings a month and, you know, they'll go anywhere from 2 to 6 hours. And then you probably have to have 2 or 3 hours of prep time leading into it. And that is like maybe baseline. But then, you know, you sit on different committees and you get emails and invited to function. So it can very easily run out, you know, mm-hmm. on you.
I can imagine.
But what I would say is, you know, right when it happened, I probably spent the next 3 weeks like really focusing in on my schedule and making sure that there was no wasted time. Even like Michael, who's here, right when we got locked in, he was like, okay, zero dead time. Like if you are scheduled for something, it is your highest use of your time. Anything else gets pushed back. And so even though I'm busier now than I was, I actually think it's been easier because I was forced to get really disciplined on my calendar, mm-hmm. you know, my scheduling.
Yeah, I feel like the calendar is everything, you know, as an entrepreneur. And as you get busier and busier, it's like, at least for me, I live by the calendar. Right. If it's not in there, I'm not doing it.
Right. That's exactly right.
But dude, it's funny. I saw that video you posted on your Instagram and I encourage all the listeners to go follow Mikey at Mikey Taylor. It puts out a lot of good content. But it was the two skateboarder kids that were at the council. What were they petitioning on?
So do you know the backstory about them?
No, I don't.
Okay, so Chad and JT, they do a podcast called Going Deep with Chad and JT, I think.
Okay.
They're like famous comedians. right? They're not skaters.
I didn't know that.
So they, I think they started off as actors and then comedians, and they're like really, really well known. On their podcast, they invited Paul Rodriguez on about 2 months ago. And for anyone who doesn't know who Paul is, he's basically the Kobe Bryant of skateboarding. He's the GOAT, unbelievable. And when he was on, they had this like spoof, right? They were like, Paul, we have this idea. Like, would you get behind this marble initiative? Like, what if we go to a city council and pitch this idea that they need to be the first city that, like, you know, is laid, everything's marble, right? Marble everywhere. And Paul was like, actually, one of my closest friends who used to be a pro skateboarder is Mikey Taylor, and he's on city council. You should go there, right? And their eyes lit up. And I saw it because everybody was tagging me in it. So I kind of had an idea that they were coming. Last Tuesday, they came. And it was so funny. I think the videos now, I think like combined, they're up to like 7 million views from last week. I mean, it's like full viral.
Yeah. What were the council members, though? What'd they think about it?
So the current council members, they had no clue, right? They didn't know, even when like they were going through their skit, they're so in character that it's actually hard to figure out if they're joking or not.
Yeah,
right?
I couldn't tell.
They come off dead serious.
Dude, they're great actors.
So like they're like looking at it going, what the heck are these guys talking about? And then there was a point where like it was kind of noticeable that like this is probably a joke. And then when it ended, they were all dying laughing.
Oh,
and then
for
the last like week or two, like that's all everybody's been talking about.
You know, you did a good job if you can get a lot of those guys to start laughing.
Totally. That's
cool, dude.
That's right.
So I want to go back a little bit, man. Like, what was it like? And I'm curious, I used to love skateboarding when I was a kid. I did it a lot. And I remember going home and we would watch like with my friends, like Thrasher videos and Shorty's videos. It was back when like Chad Muska was big and all those guys. But what was it like, you know, skateboarding every single day as a professional skateboarder growing up?
Well, when I was growing up, like, you know, we'd skate all day. It just felt like we were just being kids having fun. Basically, there was a point where it seemed like there was an opportunity that was opening for me where I, you know, had the chance to maybe become an amateur. And then, you know, the dream was to become pro. Once that happened, like right in the beginning, it's the coolest experience ever, right? It's like your dreams came true. And the thing that you love doing, you now get to do and get paid for it. Like there's a moment where it's the best. But what happens, and this is why I think you see a lot of like talented just athletes in general kind of disappear after the first few years, because once a craft becomes your career, it takes on a new meaning and it becomes a new thing. And prior to you, you know, me being a pro, there was no pressure or stress to have to perform. Like it was all based on what I was doing. And when you start having, you know, you get sponsors and you have contests that you have to go to and photo shoots and, you know, you have to sell product, the stress element of that can take away your love for the craft that originally brought you there. And that part was hard. Like, you know, the first 2 years were probably awesome. And then I had 2 years where like, I wasn't enjoying skating that much. And I almost had to like fall in love with skating all over again. And so for me, what I really started liking about skateboarding was like the business aspect of it. Like when I got my first shoe, I loved the process of, you know, trying to come up with a design, working with the design team, getting samples. Then once we had samples, figuring out how we were going to market it, talking to the sales team. Like I just love that. And once I kind of started looking at my career as like a brand, I started falling in love with it for a new reason. And that's what carried me probably the next 10 years.
What are some of the companies that you were sponsored by?
Okay, so some of the shoe brands. If you're a skater, you're going to know some of these. If you're not, maybe you won't. I was sponsored by a shoe company called S.
Is it ES?
Yeah. So that was, you know, Chad Muska with the stash in there.
And then Eric Costner.
Yep. Eric Costner was on there. So that was my first shoe sponsor. Then I was sponsored by a shoe company called DVS.
Okay.
And then from DVS, I went to Etnies. And then from Etnies, I went to DC. And DC's, most people know DC. I was sponsored by, you know, GoPro. I was sponsored by Alien Workshop, was a skateboard company. Thunder, Spitfire.
I used to skate with the Spitfire wheels.
Yeah, that's like the OG brand.
Yeah. What was it like back then getting some of these sponsorships? What would they pay you as a skater?
Okay. So in the skate industry back then, if you made $50,000 a year, you were crushing it. Like that was like psycho back then. Then Tony Hawk video game kind of exploded. And then, you know, we started hearing about some pros making like $100,000 a year. And that was like the ceiling. And then, you know, for a small group, it pushed beyond that. But for the majority of skaters, like even to this day, average salary is probably somewhere around 50 to 70 is probably the average. For me in the beginning, I think I, let's see, when I made my first $100,000, I was probably 25. And a lot of that was because of shoe sale royalties. And then, gosh, I probably started making over 200, probably closer to the, maybe right when I turned 30, 29. And then the last 4 years, I had a shoe that hit and I started making like pretty good money.
Wow. That's
even though 200 psycho money for like most people, like 200 grand is a crazy amount of money. Mm-hmm. For a skateboarder who maybe only has a career for 4 years, it's not money that's going to set you up. And then, you know, what skaters have to figure out is what happens after. And that's like the biggest challenge for us. So we just have a different experience than maybe more traditional athletes.
Would you guys get paid much doing the skater videos for some of these, like Thrasher, for example, shorties?
Yeah. So when you would do videos for sponsors, you wouldn't be paid for them. Mm. We did it basically just for brand awareness because back then there's no social media.
Yeah.
So you're
that
only,
was the social media.
That was it. So to get my name out there, the two avenues were, I mean, maybe it was three, skateboard magazines, skateboard videos, and then like contests or live events. Other than that, if you didn't do them, no one knew who you were.
Would you get paid at these contests?
If you won.
Okay.
Yeah, which I was not a contest skater, so winning a contest never happened for me.
Did you do more like street skating or more like pipes and
all
stuff like that?
Skating
all street skating.
Yeah. Stairs, handrails. Yeah.
What's the biggest stair you've ever done? Just like straight ollie over.
Straight ollie, I don't know. Maybe 16. Like
that's massive.
Yeah, dude, now it's gnarly. The handrail's bigger. Like I think I went down maybe close to a 30 stair handrail. Like,
and you're a pretty tall guy. I think
it's hard.
I'm 6 foot. You're taller than me. How tall are you?
6'2".
Okay.
Yeah,
that's
so
pretty tall for a skateboarder.
Tough. Yeah, it was.
Yeah. What size board did you ride?
You know, in the early 90s, everybody rode really skinny boards. Mm-hmm. I think I was like riding like a 7.75. Closer to the end, I was getting close to an 8.5, 8.35, 8.38. So I got wider. But the trend, trends in skating, like there was a point where everybody was doing really technical flip tricks. Mm-hmm. You need a small board for that. And then everybody wanted to go fast and, you know, look a little bit cooler. Then the boards got wider.
Have these boards changed? Like, have they evolved much today versus back then?
Because
I've seen like one of the this kid that I volunteer with, he took me to a skate shop, and I'm looking at some of the decks. I'm like, some of these companies are the same, like Birdhouse and all these other companies, but the decks look identical.
Yeah, not a lot of technology change, not at all.
That's interesting. How much does a guy like Nigel Houston? He's a badass, right? How much does he make winning these contests on an annual salary basis with all the sponsors? He's on ESPN.
Yeah, so Nigel would be like part of the 1%. Like there's a very small group of skaters that make like gnarly money. Nigel would be one of those.
What do you think? There's just
a huge gap. See, he was seven figures. You know, where in that? I'm not sure, but he would be that. Kind of rare one, but Nyjah has crossover. Like everyone knows who Nyjah is. And he didn't have to get, like, he didn't take the approach of getting a TV show to get name recognition everywhere. He just had that brand name and how good he is. And it just crossed over, you know?
Yeah. And I think also nowadays with social media, you can leverage that audience and start building your personal brand. And so post skating, like you've done it, you can leverage into your post thing, however you're going to monetize it. Because I think once you have that personal brand, you can leverage that to get into whatever you want to get into.
Right.
And that's why I think today I tell people, I'm like, man, the most important thing you can do is start putting out content.
That's right.
Start building that personal brand because that will go with you forever. And there's always ways to monetize that no matter what direction you decide to go.
Right. It's powerful. I couldn't agree more.
What's the craziest thing you've ever seen skateboarding? Like maybe the craziest trick or like the craziest just like accident you've ever seen in your skateboard career?
The craziest accident I've ever seen, one of my closest friends and arguably the most talented skateboarder to ever step on a skateboard. We were at a summer camp in Pennsylvania called Woodward, and it was late at night. He was driving a golf cart. He was 24. So he, like, when we talk prime time, and he went around a turn, couldn't see it, and there was like a big like four block, and flipped the golf cart off the stairs, and basically just natural reaction, didn't even think about it, put his leg out to stop it. And it was him and like four other people in this thing, and his leg snapped. And so he blew out his knee, busted a nerve in his ankle. They actually fixed his knee, but he hurt a nerve in his leg, and he can't pull his foot up anymore. Basically ended his career.
Oh.
And that was like a heartbreaking one, because he was like that. It'd be like AI hitting the scene and like playing for like one season and then, you know, devastating incident. So that was a bad one. Craziest like trick I've seen, it's probably all Nyjah. Like I used to travel with him, so it was like on almost a daily basis that he would do something that just didn't make sense.
Are you guys about the same age?
He's younger than me.
Yeah.
Yeah, Nyjah, I think I'm probably 12 years older than Nyjah.
Okay. So he was just coming up when you were skating with him.
Yeah, he was a child. Yeah, yeah. He was like 16.
Ryan Scheckler, he grew up in San Clemente, which is where I grew up. And Ryan's a little bit closer to age than you than Nyjah, right?
Right, yep.
Yeah. Is Ryan still skating these days?
Still skating.
Still crushed it.
Yeah,
huh?
Still skating.
At what point did you realize in your skating career that you were going to maybe transition out of it and get into the second chapter of your life?
I knew it was going to have to happen like right when I started skating. And that was kind of by and large, because when I told my parents I wasn't going to go to college, they panicked. Like they were so not okay with it. And that fear mixed with like my concern too, because I definitely grew up being taught that if you didn't go to college, doors were not going to open for you. So I felt like by me being a skateboarder, I was risking the potential of what I hoped my future would become, right? So I was concerned about it. Like I'm not going to say I wasn't. Because of that fear that I had and that my parents had, my parents were really, they pushed me to get help financially, like from an early age. So I graduated high school at 18. I turned 19 that summer. And then I had like a financial advisor, like 19 years old. And I'm making no money. Like I'm making like $1,000 a month with a financial advisor, which that part doesn't make sense. But what was cool is I had somebody come in and like help teach me kind of like some of the foundational stuff as it pertains to money, building my credit, creating a budget, learning how to invest. That was huge for me. And really what he helped me do was plan for what life after skateboarding was going to look like. But I wasn't thinking entrepreneurship at this point. All I was thinking was get as much money invested as possible. And so for the first 10 years, my strategy was live off like 20% of what I'm making and get it all invested. And even if I don't get to the point of financial freedom, at least I'm going to come somewhat close. Or even if I don't get close, that little bit of interest or cash flow I have coming in, that's going to help me during the time I'm figuring out to, you know, what life 2.0 or retirement 2.0 is going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
Then about 10 years in is when myself and my two friends had the idea to start the brewery, which we did, you know, La Jolla, we did it out here. When we had the idea for that, I thought beer was going to be the thing. Like, we're going to be in the beer industry. I'm going to start this business. We're going to run it for the next 15 years. You know, what I wasn't prepared for, and my two partners weren't either, is that we were going to have such big success at the beginning, and then we were going to end up exiting the business in 3.5 years. And that was incredible. It was like such an amazing experience. It was a blessing for our investors.
And congrats, by the way.
Thank you.
That's impressive.
Yeah, that was crazy.
For any startup.
Totally, right? Look, for people who want to start a business, anyone who started it will know this. What they don't tell you is the first 5 years, you're pretty much failing, right? Like it usually takes 5 years just to get your name out there to a little bit of people. And you usually aren't really doing anything till 5 years. Like you're just trying to get there. For us, the second we opened the doors, it went full Richter. Like the demand was just unbelievable. So we are in a situation where we couldn't keep up with demand from day one. That's the unicorn part of this. Like that's not normal. But when we sold it, we all stayed there for maybe a year and then we all took off. And what was hard for me is I thought I had figured out what was next.
Mm.
And then when it went away, it was a strange feeling. It was almost like, crap, what does this mean? I'm not skating. We don't have the brewery. What the heck am I going to do? And that probably took me a year to figure it out. That was a hard year. It was a really, really tough year for me.
In your estimation, looking back, when you guys started this brewery, you mentioned day one, you guys just had a line out the door. What was the biggest reason for that? Was that from your skating brand or what was that in your estimation?
There were a lot of factors that came into it and some of it luck and timing as well. But on the timing element, we were right on target when you talk about the opportunity in craft beer. Like, you know, what was happening is the craft beer industry was pretty much core. So if you like ever went to like a party, maybe like one person brought like, you know, a craft beer. At that time, maybe somebody brought like a Lagunitas and it was like, what the heck is that? But by and large, everybody was drinking like the normal stuff.
Bud Light, Coors Light, correct. Natty Light.
Correct. When we started getting in, we started seeing the trend start changing where it wasn't one person, like maybe it was like four, five, six. And so we were in at a point where it was becoming somewhat saturated, but there was a lot of growth happening, right? We had a phenomenal team, which played a huge part. The idea we had, which was most people were creating drinks that were, or beer that was, it was heavy to drink. Like if you drink one IPA and you were smoked, right? Mm-hmm. Where we wanted it to be a little bit easier to drink, like more sessionable is what it ended up turning into. So that was a huge factor. And then if you look at the largest one, at least from my perspective, and I don't know if my partners would share this, but this would be what I think the largest one was. There was no such thing as influencer marketing back then, right? There were no ambassadors, none of that. And one thing we did was we created basically mini documentaries on all of our investors. And our investors just happened to be pro surfers and skaters and snowboarders and musicians and artists. They became our ambassadors. So the investors became the ambassadors and we built the brand around them and their lifestyle, not about the product, right? But we made it a goal to have our liquid be really good. We wanted to win beer, win awards for our beer. So what most people did if they were famous or celebrities or maybe athletes, mm-hmm. they would come in with this like gimmick and the product would be crap. And it just felt like a fake kind of like hype move.
Salesy.
Yeah. And you know, we took the stance of if our beer can compete with everyone else and we add everything we're doing on social and we build a brand and we tell a story and we get our audience or our customer to feel like they're a part of our story, we're going to win. And it worked. We were right about that.
Dude, that's so unique. And you see some of the more successful businesses today kind of taking that same approach. Yeah. How were you guys able early on to go and get all these investors who happen to have audiences on their own? If you are a busy professional and don't have time to invest in real estate, but still want to participate in the passive income and tax benefits, my team, Summers Capital, is buying a lot of boutique hotels right now. We source the deals, we renovate the properties, and we even do all the day-to-day management, making it truly hands-off for investors. If you want to learn more to see if we can help you, go to summerscapital.com/invest to book a call with our team. Again, that's summerscapital.com/invest. Now back to the show.
Okay, so if you raise money or if you've ever tried to raise money, this will make sense to you. If you're ever going to start a business and you need to raise money, listen to this part. You usually have to start with friends and family, usually. Mm-hmm. And that's because when you're starting something for the first time, you don't have experience. And because of that, most successful investors are going to look at you and say, yeah, this is a good idea, but you don't have any proof of concept and I'm not willing to take the risk of your lack of experience. But a lot of times your friends and family believe in you and want to support you. So there's an argument that that will be the easiest capital for you to get, right? For us, you know, we pitched everyone in our network, my parents, my in-laws, my aunt and uncle, right? But we also pitched our friends. And me being a pro skateboarder, I had a lot of pro skateboarder friends. One of my partners was Paul, another pro skateboarder. Our other partner, Josh, was a surf filmmaker. So he had like the surf community unlocked. So that's who we pitched. We didn't have this plan in the beginning though to make our investors our ambassadors. What happened was we raised all the money. We were getting ready to launch and somebody was like going through our budget and I can't remember how much we had in our marketing budget. Maybe it was like $100,000 or something like that. And we thought that was a lot of money that might be able to be used somewhere else. And Josh throws out this idea. He goes, dude, what if we just freaking promoted on Instagram? It wasn't even like a built out like, you know, omnipresent social push. It was Instagram. And I was like, maybe we could do that. And he's like, dude, what if we get everybody who invested to do it? And then that morphed into basically the model that we created. And it was just the perfect storm. Now, you touched on something, which is a lot of people are doing that now. And influencer marketing is overly saturated. And, you know, anything a influencer promotes, you feel like they're being paid for it. So now you're seeing you know, 12 years later. But back then it was untouched. That is, in my perspective, what took us from a red ocean scenario and threw it into just a sea of our own. It was crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it everyone's trying to go that direction now, but you're right. Because I think, you know, when you're building a brand, people relate more to a personality.
That's right.
And they don't want to follow the brand. They want to follow the personality. And that's why you saw Nike back in the day. They went all in on Michael Jordan. They went all in on LeBron James.
Right.
And all these bigger companies, they get it. Because at the end of the day, the brand or the personality is way bigger than the brand's ever going to be. And you guys got that from day one.
Right.
Now, how about the actual piece of putting out a good quality of product? Because that's not easy to get right from the jump either. How did you guys master that part?
Okay. So that's such a valid question. Myself, Josh, Paul, we didn't have experience in the beer industry. Right. So we really relied on hiring basically a solid team from the jump. And Josh, one of my partners, has a natural ability to be captivating, and like sales stuff comes so natural to him. And so when we were looking at like hiring our brewers, he was like, I want the best. Who's the best right now?
Mm-hmm.
And there was a list that just came out, which was like the top 30 brewers under 30 in the nation. And he was like, that's who I want. I want the best. And so he basically went out and got the number one and number five top brewers in the nation under 30 and convinced them to get on board with us. And so we had like the hottest new talent at that time. And also I think the expectation was our beer was going to be crap because we had followings and, you know, we were bringing marketing into the play. And then it just became, in some regard, letting the talent do their thing. I think that's, you know, even to this day, it's easy to get in the way of talent. And so what I think we did well was we gave control to people that are great in that certain space. And then we focused on the things that we were good at.
I love that, man. And I think that's not talked about enough. A lot of people get into entrepreneurship or they start a new company and they take the approach of like, hey, I'm going to start small. I'm going to hire individuals to where I'm going to pay them 70 cents on the dollar because I can't afford to hire that, you know, more expensive individual who's more plug and play.
Right.
But in all reality, the output that you'll get for spending an extra, you know, 40% might be an additional 250%, which a lot of people don't talk about.
Right.
What do you tell those people that are looking to go the cheap route today?
That's such a good question. Okay. With St. Archer, we raised capital to start the company. So we had capital available to build out our vision. With my current business, we built it off cash flow. They are two different things. What I joke with my partner all the time, I like raising capital better for business operations. For my personality and being the one who has a vision and wants to bring that vision to reality, it's easier for me to have the capital up front to do so. Where if you're building it on the revenue from the business, it takes a lot longer. Like to your example, and this is, it's such a challenge that small startups have, which is, yeah, I hear you. Like I wanna, you know, hire the CFO for 300K. I don't have the money. Mm. Or we pick the position, right? What I would say is get creative with it, right? Look for ways to incentivize them beyond the revenue, right? If you only have, you know, if they're gonna cost you $100,000 and you only have $70,000 to pay them, okay, fine. Pay them the 70, then give them a rev split on all growth over that, or bring them in as an equity partner. Like get creative to incentivize them in different ways. And I would say that because I'm a believer of having people all in with you. Like if people own part of the business, they will die for the business. And when you're building something, that's the energy you need. It is so difficult to build that you need people that are all in. And I don't think just paying somebody accomplishes that. I think you can provide a service and you're going to pay for the level of that service, but you want somebody to go above and beyond and be in the trenches with you. They got to be a part of it for more than just a salary.
I love that. And it creates alignment of interest for, you know, your product or your service, or maybe it's a real estate deal to go well. Right. I've kind of taken the same approach here where, you know, all my team members here in the leadership team, they all get a slice of equity in all these deals.
Right.
We buy, they get a slice of the GP.
Right.
But it's not just like what you alluded to. It's not just attracting good quality people, but it's attracting people that are going to stay long term.
That's right.
Because if you have constant turnover every 6 months,
that's right,
you're not really moving the needle.
That's right.
You know?
And the other thing I would say, you in that point, like as the business start making more money, right? You as the founder or the CEO or the president, you're naturally going to want to pay yourself more, right? When you're talking about hiring people and then hiring talent that truthfully is more talented than you, that's the goal here. What you're doing is you're saying no to a raise for you to give that money to someone else, right? That's actually difficult to do. I know it sounds like easy to understand on paper. It's difficult. So you have to really get firm on the belief that you can build something larger with people, and that delayed gratification will actually pay you tenfold on the back end. But you're saying no to revenue that you can experience today, and you're giving it to other people.
Yeah, and what's that saying? They say, like, you know, getting money brings out your true colors of who you are. So if you are a tight person and you are a selfish person, getting money is going to make you a little bit more selfish. And on the flip side, if you are a generous person and it's all about the people first before you eat, you give that person some money, they're going to become even more generous. And I believe in that.
Yeah, I don't think money changes people. I don't think money changes people at all. I think it's a highlighter. And I think whatever already exists is completely magnified. I couldn't agree more. I mean, you see it today. It's like there's people that make a lot of money. They're phenomenal people. The amount of money they give, not even on like a tax incentive, and none of that. Like, they're giving people. Then there's other people, their life is miserable, right? It's just a magnifier of what you are.
Yeah. And it's the same thing of like the abundance mindset versus the scarcity mindset. Right. I think those that live abundantly and they take care of others, those are the ones that actually go further in life because they're going to attract better people into their circle, whether it's team members, family members, friends, investors, clients. They're going to go much further because at the end of the day, yes, you can be short-sighted. You can have that scarcity approach, the me first mentality, but you're not going to get very far doing that because people are going to start seeing through you.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
So back to this brewing company, what year is this for perspective when you guys launched it?
We launched in 2012. So we started, I think we came up with the idea in 11, took us about a year to figure out what the heck that meant and how to get it going. And then we sold, I believe it was at the end of 15, October of 15, I believe.
What do you guys exit at, if you don't mind sharing?
The price?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's hard to say an exact number, and I'll tell you why. When you sell a company, it's usually tiered. So you'll get a certain percentage up front, and then over a certain amount of time, it's gonna be incentive-based, right? You hit these hurdles, you get it to a certain valuation, what you get on the back end can change. For us, we sold 90% of the business, and then the 10% was incentive-based. And there was an issue in that, right? Where I'm not going to disclose too much, but the deal we had, Molson Coors had certain obligations to basically that they had to fulfill in order for us to hit our goals, and it didn't happen. And so we ended up working out a price on the end. But what I can say, it was between 50 and 80. It's fair to say it was between 50 and 80.
Dude, that's an impressive estimate.
Yeah,
I mean, you guys are kids at the time.
Yeah, it wasn't.
No experience at all in the brewing industry. And you guys throw this company together, and literally in 3.5 years, you guys exited at that valuation. That's impressive, man.
It was crazy. It was crazy. And you nailed it. That was our college experience. That was us learning.
Yeah. You know? I mean, and just think of the odds that were against you. I mean, what's that stat? Like, what percentage of small businesses fail within the first 5 years? It's like over 90%, right?
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah. Yeah.
And so for you guys to break through all those odds and then to exit at 70 to 80, that's impressive.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Who was the company that bought you guys out?
Molson Coors.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they still own it today?
They did. They oh gosh, in this last year, they canned it.
Really?
Yeah.
It's no longer around?
No.
Why did they can it?
Okay. My perspective, right?
I want to hear your perspective, man.
Building a brand is... I don't believe that most people understand how to build brands, even today. They could be generating $100 million a year. I think people still struggle understanding how to build brands. We had something very special. In my perspective, we gave them a Ferrari, and they kept it in a parking lot. They didn't know... Let's bring it back. Molson Coors is phenomenal at distribution. They're phenomenal at management, right? That's not how brand works, right? Brand is all about storytelling, connecting with your audience, making your product seem better than the product next to you, even if the product is the same, right? They didn't understand that. So when we gave them something, they, you know, for example, they looked at social media and went, this is stupid. Why are we going to do social media? Abandon that. And then all of the people that they use to tell stories, what are we doing with these guys? These have nothing to do with beer. Moot. And they put all of the focus on product and distribution. And that is the same that everyone else did, right? So when you look at what made St. Archer successful, it was that we saw what everyone else was doing and we did something different. And then when we sold it, they went, let's throw it back over to what everyone else does. And then it just slowly fizzled out. And so it's hard to see. Like, look, what is cool about selling a business is you get to make money. You get to put money in people's pocket. That's the cool part. The difficult part is you sacrifice so much to build something that it becomes a part of you. And one thing that, like, we were truly excited to sell it because we thought they were going to be able to do something with the brand that we couldn't do. This thing was going to have, you know, national or even global presence.
That was their vision.
Yeah, and we thought that was possible. And then to see it fail it's hard to watch.
Did they, because you guys had still had some sort of 10% royalty, it sounds like. Did they, because obviously they had many years to pivot, right? And maybe reverse direction. Did they ever bring you guys in for any sort of guidance along the way?
No.
Why is that, in your estimation?
I don't know. So this is just me making a wild guess. I think when you buy something from somebody and you're a very successful business, I think it's probably got to be pretty difficult to call them back and go, hey, we don't know what you're doing. Can you come help? I don't think most companies do that. I don't know if that's because of ego. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is. But what I can tell you is my partner called me not that long ago, said, I'm going to try to buy the brand back.
Really?
And tried to, and it was a hard no. Yeah.
So what did they decide to do? They just filed bankruptcy, or what did they do?
They kept the IP and sold everything else off. So they sold the brewery, sold all the equipment.
Wow.
Yeah.
Dude, that's crazy, man. And that's, you know, if you look at commercial real estate, for example, you know, you buy these deals, you fix them up, you make them worth more. You rarely see these real estate can't go to zero.
Right.
But with these companies, these private companies, get the wrong management in place, things can go south pretty quickly.
Right.
But at least you guys had a nice exit, though.
Yeah, it was cool.
I mean, you can't, that's a hell of a story that you guys are going to live forever.
That's right.
So at what point did you realize personally, after this, the St. Archer, you mentioned you guys had an exit, and then there was about a year to where you're like, man, what's next for me? What was your mindset then?
It was not good. my mindset, so from 2016, no, it was probably 17. The majority of 2017 was the hardest year of my life, for sure.
But you had some money, right?
I had money.
You had a lot of money.
This is the part it's so interesting to talk about, because it feels wrong saying this, but I had more money than I had ever kind of imagined. I wasn't working. I had no real stress on me to have to work. And I was absolutely miserable, right? And why I say, like, I don't think money will bring happiness to people. What I was struggling with was when we were doing St. Archer, I was still a pro skateboarder. And my identity was still in that as well, right? And I didn't realize how much identity and then, you know, probably purpose on top of that, how much of that was wrapped into that career and what it was actually going to feel like when that career went away. And so in that moment, the only way I can explain it was like, I felt completely lost. Like, one thing I kept telling myself over and over was like, okay, wake up today and like, you got to get back to being Mikey. Like, what this person is, it's not you. And I didn't totally understand what that meant back then. I just knew I wasn't myself. And probably about 4 months into it, I got a call from one of my friends and he goes, hey, dude, how are you? And I was totally honest with him. His name's Steve Barra. I was like, not good. I'm not good, dude. Like, I am like super depressed. Like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. And he said something that completely pissed me off when he said it, but it was so true. And so if you hear this and it's going to piss you off, it will end up being a blessing in your life. Hang on to it. He said, dude, I know you're going through a trial. I know this time is hard, but you will look back at this moment and be completely thankful for it. This will actually be one of the greatest moments in your life because it's going to put you into a position that would not have come if you weren't in it. And I remember going, dude, this is not what I want to hear, right? What I want to hear is you're going to be okay, right?
Right.
And so I hung up with him. And then probably a month later, I came to this like realization that like I couldn't figure this out on my own. Like something was wrong. And so I started spending time figuring out like what my identity was and why I felt so lost because I wasn't a skateboarder. It just like I was struggling with that one. And so I did some soul searching and like tried to like really figure out why I was here and what I was even supposed to do on this planet. And once I answered that question, then everything changed for me. How I got there, I don't even know like what happened to this, but I had this moment where I thought, you know what? One thing I've never done in my life was read the Bible. Never read the Bible before. I'm going to read the whole Bible. I don't know why this is what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that every single morning for the first 45 minutes, I was going to wake up, go downstairs, drink a coffee, read 45 minutes, right? And then after a year, I had read the whole thing. And something that was interesting was about 7 months into it, I see my wife's mom, so my mother-in-law. And she stops me and she goes, it's almost even hard to talk, it's like emotional. She goes, Mike, I just want to tell you, you today look like a completely different person than the last 15 years that I've known you. And I really like this person, right? For me, I didn't even notice that anything was changing. And she said that, I was like, holy crap, that was gnarly. And then I started looking at basically what I was here to do as I'm going to create a company that fits my identity. I'm not going to put my identity into a company. Mm-hmm. And the last 6 years have been something completely different. I've never experienced anything like this. It's been very, very good in that sense, you know?
Yeah, dude, I can totally imagine. I resonate a little bit because it's one of my favorite sayings is, or the quotes is, happiness stems from growth and progress.
Right.
And if you're no longer growing, you're no longer progressing, which just sounds like you went through that year where there maybe wasn't a lot of growth,
right,
and you were doing some soul searching, things can get a little bit lonely.
Right.
I know when I first quit my W-2 job, and I was like, you know, it was the first taste of like what financial freedom was like, you know, from a real estate investing standpoint. I initially thought, man, this is great, you know, but I got bored quick, right, and I wasn't happy,
right,
because I was no longer growing. I was not pushing the needle. And then I quickly realized, I'm like, I got to get back to it. And now I know, I'm like, dude, I'm never going to just take my foot off the gas pedal.
Right.
I think it's good to take a month and enjoy it, level up, reevaluate, see where you're going next, and then jump back into it. But I don't think I'll be able to ever just go sit on the beach for a year.
No, I don't either. Honestly, I don't think that's like what we're supposed to do at all. Like, I don't think we're really meant to retire. I know we have this like dream of like, I'm going to work my butt off to like 60 and then like go golf every day. And I actually don't think that's what we're supposed to do. I think we're supposed to work till the end. I just think as you get older, you know, what you can manage becomes less, I think. But, you know, you hear about this all the time. Like when people stop working, you know, when they're older, the time frame to when they die becomes much shorter than those who work longer, right? Like there's something about holding responsibility and being here to do a task that day, I think keeps us alive. And so I don't know, part of me is like wrestling with this. Like, I don't know if our dream is the right dream. I don't know if the dream is never work.
Yeah. And that's such a good, like, interesting stat. It's so true. Like, you need some sort of purpose, and that's what keeps us young. That's what gives us the drive to keep going. And that's why you see some people that are into their 90s and they're still working out and they have a young lifestyle and personality, and others, they die at 50 years old,
right,
you know? And a lot of that is the drive and their purpose.
Right. Even look at older couples, right? Like, you ever seen a scenario, it's happened with my grandparents, like you have two healthy people and then maybe one gets sick and then the husband or the wife dies. And usually the partner left, they don't live that much longer after that, right? I think there is this importance in waking up and having something to do and having a reason for being here. And I think it's overlooked.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that, dude. So at this point, at what point did you, like, where did real estate investing come into the picture? Hey guys, real quick, the only way this podcast grows is if you guys share it and review the show. So if you do find value, if you could take 2 seconds and drop a 5-star on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, it would mean the world to me. But more importantly, it will help us reach new audiences and help more people build wealth through real estate investing.
Yeah, so real estate investing came into the picture when I was younger. My mentor that my mom connected me with, my parents.
That was the financial advisor.
Financial advisor. He had a brother who ran a storage portfolio. And that was my introduction into investing passively into commercial real estate. And there was something about real estate that felt very comfortable. And I always had confidence that it was going to be there. And then when I started investing in it passively, I started getting, like, in that offering, the cash flow is paid out quarterly, right? So I kept getting these quarterly checks. And like after the third, fourth one, you're like, yo, this is it. Like, mm-hmm. I can count on this. I'm here for it. And so that, you know, I was doing that for a pretty good amount of my career. So when we sold Sierra Archer, I was trying to figure out what else to do. One, I didn't want to just be an investor. Like I really enjoy building business. I really enjoy coming up with an idea and having to figure out how to bring that to reality. I like that part. But what I liked about St. Archer was having to go out and raise money. Like, I like that we had a business plan and a concept that we couldn't afford ourselves. And we had to go out, pitch people, bring them in, and then manage the money responsibly. And then we got to see it full circle. And I'll tell you, there's nothing better than putting dollars in somebody's hands. It's the greatest feeling. And so I really wanted to kind of blend both of those worlds together. And then that mixed with, I really wanted to create an opportunity for athletes. Like, you know, that was one thing that I was blessed by. I was given knowledge, kind of empowerment and opportunity. So I wanted my company to have an opportunity that people could invest in, that they could count on being there. And then I wanted there to be an educational part to it. It's why we put so much content on social about financial literacy and education. And real estate was that asset class that I felt accomplish the goal for an athlete, which is we need to build our wealth because we're young, but we're, you know, we love cash flow. Cash flow is how we take control away from our employer, right? Mm-hmm. And it just, it accomplished all the goals.
I love that. And so you knew real estate was the answer. And then how did it evolve from there? Because now you're doing self-storage deals, you're doing ground up development, yeah, multifamily deals. But what was kind of the catalyst of to get you to where you are now?
Okay, so basically when I was skating, I was investing in storage passively, and I was investing in a debt fund as well. So I was lending on commercial real estate. When I came up with the idea for Commune, at this point I knew how to build business and I knew how to raise money. So I'm working on my business plan, and I don't know why I thought this at this time, but I wanted to do a fund instead of a syndication. Mm-hmm. Knowing what I know now, I should have done a syndication. But anyway, I want to do a fund. And I wanted it to be in multifamily. Like, I had no exposure to multifamily back then. And I thought multifamily fit my skill set better than storage. I'll explain why in a second. And so I brought my business plan to my financial advisor. And I had this page that was basically fund management. And there was a question mark. I didn't know what that meant. And so I asked him, I'm like, what am I missing here? Like, can you help, like, educate me on this? Or, like, who are the people that I need to bring in to, like, help build this out? And he called his brother, Jerry, yeah, come in here. We gotta get a look at this. And what we ended up doing is we started a business together. And with the storage portfolio that I was investing in, how it works is you have a management company, and that management company manages the fund. But the company doesn't own the fund. The investors own the fund, right? So they had their management company. They had their fund that I was investing in. We created a new management company together and then a new fund that was focused on multifamily. Right? That's what Commune was. And then about 3.5 years into it, we were seeing like such crazy growth because of the brand element and social, and a lot of the stuff that we did with St. Archer, we are doing with Commune. And my partners who ran the other management company as well, basically threw out the idea about us merging our companies together. And that ended up leading to us doing it down the road. It was about 2.5 years ago we merged. And so both management companies became one. It became Commune. And then the debt fund that I was investing in, the storage portfolio, and then the multifamily portfolio that we started all became Commune. And then from that point, we've created two additional funds and then a handful of syndications along the way.
Now, you guys are or you're not owner-operators?
Some stuff we are, some stuff we aren't. Okay. What we try to do, and this is by and large our structure, our strategy, we like partnering with developers. So we have a handful of developing partners that we do most of our deals with. And so that puts us in a position of being able to do it at scale. If we were a private equity firm and a development and the management company, we're not there. So that's how we like structuring it. What that means for our company, we come on as the sole investor, we come on as the equity. And then we have certain controls that we have to have. We have to have full control to take over a project if something goes wrong. Now, we do have the ability to develop ourselves, and we have done that in the past. And there are a handful of projects that we self-manage, but by and large, we have third-party management, and we like to partner with developers.
And so with that, if you were to develop it yourself, and you mentioned that you guys could, what does that entail? That means that you guys are the ones that are managing this whole development project. You guys are the ones making sure the permits get done. You guys are managing the contractors, basically the A to Z, the budgeting, all that.
Yeah.
But if you guys source that out and partner with a developer, you guys are just placing the equity. Is that right?
Yeah. So I'll, this will make more sense as I explain the partnership. One of my partners is our head of development, and he is a developer. Like that, his background was development. He built one of our storage portfolios. One of our storage units, the largest one we own. And what we started doing is we put him in a position of overseeing the developing partners. So he's kind of he would be like, you know, the developing partner would be the entrepreneur and we'd be the VC and, you know, he would be the ones overseeing the entrepreneurs, right? That has allowed us to do it at scale, but we have a project right now where we added about 350 units onto our existing, I think we had like 1,400 total. He oversaw that project. So he goes through the permits. He acts as the GC. He does it soup to nuts. Is that the phrase, soup to nuts?
Mm-hmm.
We just don't try to do it a lot like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so, yeah, it's an interesting business model, man. And I like how you partnered with your guy, brought it all in. Now, self-storage is a lot different than this development, multifamily stuff. However, you guys are repurposing old retail facilities and then converting them over to self-storage. Is that the model there?
Correct. Yeah, big box retail.
And which, I'm curious, is it same, do you guys co-mingle the funds amongst these different projects and these different asset classes, or is it two separate funds and two separate investors for each one?
Yeah, really good question. So our storage portfolio is our fund is the storage fund. The only thing in there is storage. And then in our multifamily, it's only multifamily. And then we have two multifamily funds. So what we do is we go after basically big box retail, Kmarts, Walmarts, Bed Bath & Beyonds that go vacant, become distressed. And when it all works out, which is difficult to do so, we basically scrape the inside and fill it with, you know, anywhere between 1,000 and 1,300 units. For our portfolio, we have one developing partner that we primarily work with. And then we have other projects that we've done on our own. But the repurposing we like doing with partners. It's a lot of brain damage to get those projects through. The cities don't like them. Mm-hmm. And so very similar structure, I guess, with all that said.
With those projects, I'm curious, are you bringing the investors in right away? Or are you bringing them in on the back end when you kind of have a little bit more due diligence done?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So your podcast is primarily real estate listeners, right? So we don't like bringing our investors in pre-entitlement. It's a risk that we just don't want them to take. So we usually bring them in once it's entitled or we are right about to be entitled and we feel highly, highly confident that we're going to get there. That's usually when we bring them in. What we like about that is that's our, you know, some people that buy like existing product, they'll say, you know, you make money when you buy, not when you sell. And mm-hmm. and you should buy with existing equity, meaning, you know, if you're going to buy an apartment for $1 million and you're able to negotiate the price down to 900, well, you just bought it with $100,000 of equity right off the jump, right?
Sure.
We kind of like using that analogy in development where we think we're doing all of this value and we think there's value on the paper by, you know, getting it entitled and ready to build. And so we like the idea of bringing them in. It's just one of our kind of value add to the investor, I guess you could say.
Yeah, that makes sense. So are you guys closing on these retail centers that are, let's say, it's a Kmart, for example, in whatever city? Are you guys closing and acquiring this piece of land or this property with your own funds? And then you're bringing the investors in when you got the entitlement and all that ready to go?
Typically what we do.
Okay. Yeah. What's the biggest risk with these projects?
With all of them or in storage?
The self-storage.
Okay, so if the project is entitled, right? Let's say the city will allow you to do it and you start building, you have to be really careful that you're not building in an area that's saturated. Storage, there's it's kind of it's pretty saturated right now. So you run the risk that you're not going to be able to lease it up at the rents that you thought. This is the easiest way to say it. There's a lot of similar, there's crossover between multifamily and storage, right? Like when you're looking at a multifamily project, what you're really looking at it is, does this project have demand over the next 10 years, right? Can I get the rents I want to get and will there be demand for the next 10 years? If the answer is yes, then, you know, considering you gave yourself options, you're going to be pretty good. Mm-hmm. Storage is similar to that, but the challenge is if you're doing a value add play or a repurpose play, what you're usually doing is short-term debt or bridge debt until it's stabilized, then moving into permanent financing, right? Mm-hmm. The bridge debt market is built more for multifamily. There's not a lot of product that really fits storage. And the reason why I say that, it takes longer to stabilize. So what you end up seeing a lot of storage operators do is they go like bridge loan, then to permanent. If you're in a moment like this, this would be a good way to highlight, you know, what the risk is. If you started building something, I don't know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and you're in lease-up process and you underwrote it for a certain interest rate, maybe a certain debt yield or all of the metrics that would help you qualify for your permanent financing, you might not qualify now. And so there's a real risk that you may need liquidity at a time that might be challenging to get it.
Yeah, I can imagine with these retail spots you're repurposing to self-storage, there's a period of time from a lender's perspective to where this property is not worth a lot of money.
Right.
But on the flip side, like a multifamily deal that you're doing some value add or renovation package, there's still tenants living in the property. Right. And from a risk standpoint, that property still has a lot of value. So it makes sense. And I kind of see that.
And then I would say there is risk on the entitlement. Like it is very difficult to get these things entitled. Like most cities, we talked about this earlier. Most cities do not like storage. And then also they don't want storage in what used to be a retail center in a prime location of the community. They want to put storage on the outskirts. And so, you know, when you lock a project up under contract, it takes a lot of time and it takes money to, in a lot of cases, know that you're not going to get it through. So that is a potential
risk.
What's
the exit strategy then if you guys acquire the property with your own money? You realize, hey, we can't convert it. What's the exit strategy?
We won't acquire it. We'll put it under contract, and then it'll be contingent on that.
So you guys have certain. Okay, got it. That's in the LOI, where when you put it under contract, that's in the agreement. Yeah. These are the terms.
We
have to have the entitlement before we close.
Correct. We will not close if we can't get it entitled.
So these are long contracts.
Oh yeah.
How long is the longest one you've seen?
We've worked on projects where we're trying to get the deal through. For year, 2 years, it dies, comes back to life 2 years later, takes another year of us working. I mean, things die over and over and come back.
Yeah.
That's part of the process here.
When you get a no, is it typically a hard no, or is it like, okay, there's a way to figure out how to turn the no to a yes? You just got to get more creative.
Well, look, being on city council now, like this is actually, it's interesting because I'm experiencing on the other end. Mm-hmm. Every 2 years, you have people that have potential to move positions, right? And you might have a scenario with a city where you have three of the five council members that are maybe more pro-growth. And then in a different cycle, it might be flipped. And so there's an argument to be said that you wait council members out. The other part is it's understandable, right? If you had a Kmart and a Kmart created jobs and creates revenue for the city, everything, right? If it's vacant, and let's say it's vacant for a year, you're still kind of hoping that it can become something else, not storage. Well, the longer it sits vacant and the more you start seeing things like, you know, weeds growing up, you know, out of the cement or windows being broken and they're not getting fixed, that's a pretty scary place for a city to be. And so, you know, if it's still sitting there, that puts more pressure on a city to go, we have to figure this out. And so that sometimes is a big factor.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I can see why these cities don't necessarily want the self-storage, especially in the more congested parts of town where there's a lot of drive-by traffic, because, I mean, let's be honest, the self-storage is not the most aesthetically pleasing property. And similar to mobile home parks, probably not quite the same stigma. And you mentioned before we started recording that, you know, these self-storage facilities also, they're not creating a ton of jobs. you could have a huge facility and maybe only have one or two people on site.
Right. That's exactly right.
So I get that.
Multifamily is much easier to get through right now.
I can imagine.
There's so much demand that most council members now throughout, I mean, in our state for sure, but most of them are going, yes, 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 yes.
Yeah, it's and this is California too. I mean, bureaucracy here is definitely more challenging than a lot of other states.
Yeah, so our portfolio is hyper focused on California, the multifamily side. The storage side, we have one asset here. Everything else is out of state. So our strategy is very difficult to be hyper focused on a market, but multifamily, it's a lot easier to do so. So that's why they're different in that strategy.
Are these different investors in both of your funds? Are they typically investors that are kind of diversified across both assets?
They don't have to be. There's definitely some that are in all of our funds. Mm-hmm. And then there's some that resonate with the asset, not the return profile, right? There's some people that look at me and go, I don't care for storage. I don't want it. Like, I understand it's a great return. I'm good though. And they'll go into multifamily, or let's just say multifamily, because they think it just feels cooler or seems cooler. Others that are looking at it through maybe a risk profile or what the purpose of the entity is, mm-hmm. that might drive their decision. For example, you know, our storage portfolio is closed right now, but when it's open, an investor comes in and gets to participate in cash flow right away, and then they get to participate in growth. So you get kind of a hybrid between growth and cash flow. Our multifamily portfolio, it's all growth. So for new investors that come in, they're saying no to cash flow now to, you know, potentially get a bigger return or build it to the desired cap rate in the future. And so that will put some people in here and not the other. And then in the debt portfolio, you know, somebody who just wants, you know, income and wants to remove the equity risk, you know, maybe that's a better fit for them. So it's a little bit all over the board.
Yeah. You mentioned that when you got into the commercial real estate, you first started the fund, and had you done it again, you would have maybe just started with a single asset syndication. Why do you say that?
There's pros and cons to both, but funds are a lot harder to raise money for. In our experience, it's more difficult. If you're raising for a syndication, it's much more simple for an investor to understand. This is the one project. This is the targeted return. This is the targeted timeline when you're going to start seeing cash flow. This is the time we're going to try to exit. It's just a clear shot for them. Also, when you close, you're closed. You don't get another shot, right? So there's an element of FOMO for whatever reason where people are like, if I don't get into this one, I lose this opportunity. Mm-hmm. Where when you go into a fund, you don't have that urgency at every time to go, if you miss this deal, you're out. It's, okay, so you're going to close on this one, but you're still going to raise for these three. And yeah, I'll just wait till the next one, right?
Yeah.
And then also, it's a little bit more complicated for an investor to understand because you're now looking at multiple deals. And if you're in development, you know, the cash flow is spread out. And usually, you're not going to distribute cash flow when the first one is cash flowing, or you're not going to distribute a dividend when the first one cash flows because you want to use that cash flow into the next deal so it's less dilutive, right? And then it makes it way more difficult to show an investor, this is when you see money. But there's a lot of pros to the fund. I mean, from an operational standpoint, that is way easier in my perspective. You get diversification. If you build it to a certain point, all of a sudden like a line of credit comes into play. And that was huge for us with our storage portfolio. Having a line of credit allows you to be very, very quick on acquisitions.
When you say a line of credit, when you establish your fund, what do you mean exactly?
Yeah, so basically a bank is not typically going to give you a line of credit on a syndication, but when you have a portfolio of assets that are stabilized, you get to a point where a bank will start giving you a line of credit that's, you know, collateralized by your assets, and you can draw from that. You don't have to raise money. So if you have a $10 million line, think about, you know, when you're having to close on an acquisition, you don't necessarily have to go through the challenge of raising capital in the time frame to close. You use that, then you can backfill the investor to follow, you know.
So you could, let's just say you got a fund with four assets within it, they're all stabilized. Each of the four assets has its own mortgage in first position. You're saying as long as you got enough equity amongst the four assets and they're stabilized, a bank will come to you and say, hey, we'll give you a line of credit for a portion of that equity that you have.
Correct.
Dude, that's awesome.
That part is phenomenal.
I didn't know that.
You can't do that on syndications. Mm-hmm. And it took us a long time to get there. But if you're willing to go through the challenge of raising capital for a fund, that is a huge advantage. It's a huge advantage for your investors.
Yeah, that's something I didn't even realize. We just launched our first fund and in the middle of the raise right now. But yeah, that is a very, very intriguing thing I didn't even think about. The other thing is, you know, from a diversification standpoint, it's like if one of the four deals, you know, falls a little bit short from an assumption standpoint and the other three deals are good, well, now the blended return is still in the green.
You just reminded me of why I wanted to start a fund and not a syndication. So I wanted to use social media to build this portfolio, to build this brand. And in the beginning, I was like, shoot, what's it going to look like if I bring different investors into different, let's say, apartments, and one apartment doesn't perform at the same rate as the other? And will I run the risk of having some investors going, this is great, some investors going, this isn't what he says he is? And so I think in the beginning, I felt like it was easier to maybe have a consistent experience, but syndications are easy to raise capital for. They definitely are.
Yeah, definitely.
And we're out here launching funds, like, you know?
Yeah, I can see that. You know, especially early on, it's like, well, okay, with ours, it's four assets, you know? And so if it's early on and you only have one, maybe two identified, some of the investors that, especially newer investors, might say, hey, let me get in on another round when we have established financials for the first couple, and they can kind of have a clearer picture of what exactly is going to be in the fund. So I totally get that. But from an operations standpoint, it's so much simpler. I mean, one set of reporting, one set of investors, versus four, or if you have six properties, that's six different set of investors, different sets of reporting. That's a lot more workload,
you know?
And so I can see the pros and cons. And for me, I figured, you know what? There's never going to be a perfect time to do it. And so I was like, let's do it.
Yeah.
Now's the time. Let's rock and roll. And our investors are excited for it, but it's been fun. What is the biggest risk on the development side? You guys are doing the multifamily ground up. What's the biggest risk in those deals?
Oh, okay. So look, in this moment in time, I think the refi risk is the greatest risk for us right now.
Because of the rate environment?
Yeah. So basically, you know, we got the Fed trying to get a grasp on inflation, right? We talked about this today. And we think we know what the Fed's going to do. But if you listen to, you know, Jerome Powell talk about it, he alludes to a possibility of something, but he never commits to it. The Fed is 90% talk, 10% action, right? And really what he's saying is, we're going to look at this from a, you know, day-to-day basis and just, you know, look at the data. Mm. Because of that, we're in a scenario where we have a inverted cap rate, right? We have interest rates higher than the cap rates, especially in our market. And so you have to ask yourself, okay, is interest rates going to continue to go up? Will cap rates follow? They don't have to. In the 80s, they definitely didn't. And on top of that, what are the banks underwriting to today? And what are they going to underwrite to a year, 2 years from now? And how different is that than it was last year or the year before, right? So if you were underwriting, you know, we talked about being conservative in our underwriting. If you were underwriting your project once it was stabilized and moving into your permanent financing off of, you know, let's call it a 5 cap, or, you know, the bank requiring a 7% debt yield, or a, you know, certain debt service coverage ratio, whatever it is, it's not the same today. They're now requiring more. And so you run the risk of not qualifying for that permanent financing and having to put more equity in the deal, right? Having a liquidity crisis or liquidity squeeze. That is a challenge, right? If you take this moment out, like, what's the typical risk for building? You have your entitlement risk. You have the risk of you not expecting the unexpected to happen, right? So if you're expecting the project to take a year and a half to build, and you didn't prepare for the scenario where it could take 2 years or even longer than 2 years, if you're expecting to hit certain rents and, you know, maybe you're not able to, you're hitting a 20% discount, if you, you know, run over your budget by 20%, these are all factors that are risks that can put your asset, you know, in a distressed scenario. If you prepare for it, okay, I think you put yourself in a position to succeed. But what we see a lot of investors do is everything has to go according to plan to succeed. And that is not a reality. That never happens. So I think that would be the risk.
But you guys are mitigating a lot of these risks. I'm sure you guys are underwriting to a more conservative exit cap rate and maybe a more conservative DSCR on the refi.
Right.
And then I'm sure you guys are raising additional funds for contingency capital should there be change orders or should you go over budget or even timeline.
Right.
And that's one way to mitigate it. Now it's gonna lower the return profile.
Correct.
The target return profile. And so that's another thing. It probably makes it a little bit more challenging to raise capital when your return profile is reduced by 3, 4, 5 basis points. But the investors that are savvy are going to, they're going to understand that and they'll appreciate that.
Right.
And I think it makes it a little bit easier to, under promise over deliver if you would versus going the other route. Hey, we'll get the money in right away. However, everything has to be lined up for us to hit that projection.
Right. We are a conservative group. Like we have investors that do not invest with us because they think we are too conservative, and that's what they should do. That's fair. But you know, when we're underwriting a deal, and you know, we talked about this earlier, which it sounds like there's a lot of similarities here. When you're building something, you know, if it's going to take you 2 years to build it, let's say a year to stabilize, at year four, like right after it stabilized, if you were to sell it, that's going to be your highest return because of the time, or the highest IRR because of the time, right? Mm-hmm. And so when we look at a deal, we typically look at it as at a 5-year hold and see what the return looks like. But then we also stretch it out and actually underwrite it to a 10-year hold. And that's really what we're looking for is, you know, what happens in a scenario where we can't sell it at year 5? And if we can't, is this an asset we want to hold for 10 years? And if we do hold it for 10 years, what's the return at that point? And so that's one thing that we, you know, when we're talking to new investors, we're walking them through that timeline. Look, this is what we're hoping for, but if we can't do it, this is what we're prepared for, and this is the return in that case. And then even when we're looking at our modeling, you know, we talked about some of the things that could go wrong. You know, we project, you know, certain scenarios in the future, and we rely heavily on, like, you know, CoStar and The Economist, et cetera. But even if they're saying, you know, in this market, you can expect a 5%, you know, rent increase per year, we're going to underwrite it to that. But then we're also going to look at a model where, what if there's no rent growth, right? If they're saying the, you know, cap rate in year 5, they're projecting it to be, you know, a 5 cap. Well, what does this thing look like at a 6, right? What happens when we talked about, you know, timeline to build? If we're expecting to build it in 2 years, what happens if we hold it for 6 years? And when we're doing that, we're looking at all of the ways each component brings the return down. And then basically how we figure this out at the end is, what happens if we're in like a doomsday scenario? What if we're in Armageddon and we hit all of the levers, right? Everything goes wrong. What does this deal look like? And that return goes way down. Like, you know, we ran this on a current deal. I think the return went down to like a 2% return. But
you're not losing money.
In a scenario where everyone else is losing money, we're okay with that. Mm-hmm. You know, in Armageddon scenario, we still make a little money. We're okay with that.
And if you get into that scenario and you can hold the asset for another 3, 4, 5 years to where things will improve, and they will improve, then you're going to be good. And I love that you guys are, you know, underwriting to a longer time horizon. It's like, hey, tell the investor, like, if we can get this 10-year projected return in year 5, we're going to look to do that.
Right.
However, if it's not an opportune time to exit in year 4, year 5, we're prepared to hold this asset, you know, 10 years if we need to,
because
we're protecting your capital.
That's right. And this just played out this way. We had two projects that we raised money for, I don't know, 4.5 years ago, and we pitched on that. We ended up selling them. We had a great experience. Everybody gets money, like everybody's happy. But if we weren't able to sell, we were fine. And then I think that the last thing I would add to it is, we're really focusing on markets that are severely undersupplied, like severely. And really what we want to feel comfortable with is the demand side. We want there to be demand for the next 10 years, because if there's demand and you've underwrote it the right way and you've prepared for the unknown, so what? Like, participate in cash flow when cap rates soften. There's nothing that forces you to sell. There's nothing that forces you to sell. I am totally good with that.
Some of the markets I know on the multifamily side where there's a lot of demand, there's a lot of growth. Some of the hotter markets, let's say Phoenix right now, that's been a really hot market. A lot of markets in Texas, some of the markets in Florida come with a lot of new builds, right? But I noticed you guys are doing multifamily stuff here in California where there's a lot of bureaucracy. And so there's a higher barrier to entry to build.
That's right.
And so I love that play, because not only are you guys going into markets where there's, you know, always going to be demand, people are always going to be wanting to live in California, especially people that make money. But on the flip side, you don't run the risk of oversupply because of all the bureaucracy and red tape that we have here.
That's right. Like, look, when we talk about investing in California, I hear it all on social media. People think we're crazy, and I get it, right? I totally get it. What you touched on is the normal cycle, right? You have a market that's hot and it's easy to build. The builders go there and build, right? Money typically flows where it's easily accessible or the least amount of friction, right? Mm-hmm. But what happens because of that is they build too much. This is such a normal cycle. And then it oversupplies and the market corrects, right? What we like is actually what drives a lot of investors out of California, right? One of the perfect examples would be this new mansion tax in LA City.
Oh man, don't get me started with that.
But you know what? It's another example barrier to it, right? You're now adding an additional cost if you sell an asset, right? I think the breakdown is you sell an asset between 5 and 10 million, it's a 4% tax. If you sell it north of 10, it's a 5.5% tax,
yep,
something like
exactly
that, right? But it applies to multifamily as well, right? Well, here's the reality. You just made the cost of doing business in California more expensive. There will be investors that will not build here now, right? For investors like us, we go, wait, so you're keeping our competition out in a market that's undersupplied? Like, okay. You know, yeah. And then you add, the elements of how long it takes to get a project online. Like, one of the projects that we're building out right now, from the point of us first working on it till us actually stabilizing it, it's going to be 6 years, right? It is just not easy to do so. And so we think there's a strong case to be made that because it is so difficult, it artificially drives prices up. And if you know how to build here, which it is hard, we've seen a very good return because of it.
I feel like a lot of the people that dog investing or buying in California, they've actually never owned real estate here.
Right.
Which is intriguing. But
and look, I will say this. Like, I'm not mad at you. Like,
no, for sure. I get it.
You know what I'm saying? It is brutal and it takes a lot of time. And in that time, if you don't know how to do it, you can lose money. But we've been doing it a long time. And I do like, at the end of the day, the idea that I don't think we're going to be able to hit demand.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we are so undersupplied. Just from, like, if we were to go back when we started St. Archer, and that was part of our pitch, like, hey, investors, look, there is so much demand that we will never be able to produce enough. Every single drop we make, no matter what, it's gone. In 2 seconds, it's gone. Everybody would be giving us, are you kidding me? That's like the ultimate sales pitch.
Right.
In California real estate, in a lot of the markets, you can kind of make that pitch.
Yeah, no, that makes sense, man. And I just think, like, if you look at the real estate here, low cap rates, sales comps are very expensive. You guys are doing ground up development. And I always tell people, whether you're doing a heavy, lift or it's a ground up development, well, it's a lot of time and work that goes into these projects. And relatively speaking, it's the same time and cost to build in the middle of the country in Oklahoma than it is here in a hot market in California. But I know we're going to create a lot more equity growth,
right?
And we're going to have a much larger delta to capture by doing it out here in a hot market in California. So I totally get that.
Yeah, that's right.
And kudos to you, man, for the strategy there. I
appreciate that.
I want to switch gears a little bit. With all the stuff right now, we got the recent bank collapses. We got this high, interest rate environment that we're in. There's a lot of bad news out there in the marketplace. Where do you kind of see things navigating over the short to midterm, the next 6 to 12 months?
That's a good one. I'm going to start by saying, who knows? Because we're in a different position where today than I thought we were going to be. Like, a lot of the numbers that we just saw, we saw the unemployment, we saw the job numbers healthy, right? Which, when you think of that through the lens of inflation, that's a bad sign for inflation. That means the demand is still high, right? When you look at wage growth, right? You now have wage growth below inflation, which I don't want this to sound as if it's a good thing, but just in the context to inflation, that would actually be a good sign that inflation is coming down. With all that said, my expectation, I think we're going into a recession. I know, everyone talks about a soft landing or a scenario where we avoid it. I'm not sure how we do that if the goal is get inflation down. What I'm kind of expecting the Fed to do, I think we're going to see another rate increase, and then I'm probably expecting a pause. It's so hard to say. Mm-hmm. It is so hard to say.
The bond market is pricing in, they were pricing in this most recent hike they did a week ago, but they're not pricing in a future one.
I know, but
and
this,
so we'll see how it reacts.
That part's interesting to me, yeah. Right? I was looking at this the other day. You have investors that are pretty much like, we're seeing a pause. You saw this increase of demand in mortgage, right? You're seeing the energy go, pause, right? So then the question becomes, okay, so if that is the experience, what's that going to do to demand? Is everybody now going to think like, dude, we're good. Let's put more juice in it. And then is inflation going to run back up, right? And that's something you saw in the 80s. It's like they thought they had inflation, you know, handled. They didn't. And then Volcker went scorched earth on them, right? So I don't know. Now, the hard part and why I'm glad I have no involvement with the Fed, a lot of the things that we've seen them do over the last, I mean, how long have we been doing this tightening thing for? A year?
Yeah.
All of it hasn't totally come into effect, right? There's a lagging factor. Mm-hmm. And so if they keep going, there is the argument that they went too far and this thing, we get put into a deep recession, right? That's totally fair and at play. I don't know if we're going to know if the Fed is making the right decision without hindsight. I think that's the only way we're going to know this. But I do think we're going to get into a recession. I think, you know, it's going to be uncomfortable for sure. I'm not expecting the real estate market to crash. Like you saw like Elon, we saw some people going, you know, the commercial real estate market is in for a spanking, right? I don't think that. I think there's going to be an opportunity for, you know, pref equity, or there's going to be recapitalization opportunity. I don't think we're going to see like blood in the streets. Office, maybe. Everything else, I don't see it.
Office was struggling a little bit before, I mean, all these rate hikes, and I get that. But, you know, to your point, man, what you're buying and what we're buying right now in this climate, we're buying deals where we're adding a tremendous value.
Right.
And so you pricing all that equity growth, you know, the market can continue to soften, cap rates can continue to go up for the next couple of years. And then you factor in the fact, you know, you have a 10-year time horizon. It adds a lot of safety there. But if you're buying turnkey product right now, and you're paying retail pricing, and you don't have much value add potential in these deals to create that buffer, that's where I think you're going to see a little bit of trouble right now.
Yeah, I think you will. But maybe this is adding to it. Maybe this is pushing back. I'm not sure. But for us, like the smaller investors, 1,000%. Like for the ones who actually move the needle, the institutional investors, like when you look at them, right, they're looking at what can I get for a 30-year treasury? I mean, 30-year treasury, get 4%, right? Mm-hmm. Or I can buy a couple apartments in cash, right, at a 4 cap, let's say. And, you know, I'll diversify and I'll buy them in nice markets. But if inflation is the issue, okay, well, is that inflation going to increase my rents? Typically yeah. Does. And so now I have the 4% alternative to a bond with the potential of growth through inflation. I think that's how they look at it. And I think they're the ones that move the needle. I think for us, we don't have the buying power that they do. But for the investors like us, I think there's much more risk if you're going to try to, you know, finance a project that's stabilized or turnkey and bank on your growth from
organic.
I think there's a risk there because you're buying negative cash right now. Like the cap rate it's below the interest rate.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you see interest rates normalizing here? Because obviously the Fed has all the control. You know, maybe they pause these rate hikes. And I think once they pause, they're probably not going to go back to it, or they shouldn't. And maybe they do another, you know, quarter basis point, but or 25 basis point increase. However, where do you kind of see interest rates normalizing once they normalize here in the next 6 to 12 months?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm trying to take the Fed's conversation or their plan at face value. I'm expecting a hold. I think as we get into 2024, I think that's when we start seeing interest rates coming down. I wouldn't be surprised if we see a pause this year for the rest of the year. There's people that see that differently, but that's kind of my expectation. I think 2024, we start seeing them come back down. Where do they land? That's an interesting conversation. Will we see like 0% again? I don't know.
Yeah.
I can make the argument. I've heard the argument on both sides. What we're planning for is interest rates not coming back down. What we're planning for is them staying and potentially going up, even though I don't think that's what's going to happen, is how I'm looking at it. So yeah. I don't know. Like on where do they land? I don't know yet. That's a good question. I don't know yet.
Yeah, that's kind of what we're doing with our deals right now. From an underwriting standpoint, we're pricing in that we'll, you know, be refinancing into perm debt sometime in 2025-ish at around a 6.5% interest rate, which means the Fed rate will be about 4.5.
Yeah, like I think that's high.
I guess conservative.
I think that's high. Yeah. Honestly, in 2025, I don't think that's what we're refinancing in.
I agree.
But I agree with you. That's what we're planning for.
Yeah. And so I'm like, you know what? Let's be conservative. If the deals pencil at this higher, you know, interest rate, this higher cap rate, let's do it. Even though we got to show the investor a lower return profile because we're being conservative, I'm like, let's just do it. Because I don't want to overpromise and underdeliver.
Right.
I don't want to do that.
I agree.
You know,
I agree.
I know it'll be a little bit harder to bring the money in, but you know, there's always a give or take, and I'd rather go that option.
If you under promise and over deliver, you will be here for a long time. If you oversell and don't deliver, your run will be short lived. That's just how it works.
That's so powerful, dude. As we kind of close out to the end of the show, I wanted to ask you, man, like what are you most excited for as we kind of, you know, get through the remainder of 23, 24, you did the skateboarding thing. Yeah, you guys hit the gold with the brewery, and now you're buying a bunch of commercial real estate. You got your family, you got kids, but like what gets you out of bed these days, man? What gets you excited?
Okay. There's a few things, and I want to make sure I stack them accordingly. I would say what gets me out of the bed first and foremost, I want my kids to see a good example of what a husband and a father look like. Like I want my girls to see, you know, for who they end up, you know, dating and you know, eventually marrying. I want to give them a good, you know, visual of that. And then for my son, I want my son to see what a man is and how a man is here for his wife. And so I would probably say that's first, but what I also want them to see is what it's like to work hard. And I want them to see what it's like to manage responsibility. And then why I would probably say second is what we're doing with the business. And then I would say third is everything I'm doing with the community. If you're looking at, you know, some of these goals for our business, like we've been working on a Regulation A Plus offering that I really want to have live this year. I am really, really, really like hot on that one. Some of our goals, we want to get to $1 billion of AUM. Our goal is to do it the next 5.
Where are you guys at now?
From a growth standpoint, we're managing about 250. I want to do, let me take a step back. Our goal over the next 5, I want to be managing $1 billion of real estate. So we're about a quarter of the way there. The second goal would be, I want to be managing $1 billion of equity, like true AUM. I think we're a little bit further out on that one, but that's definitely a goal of ours. And then for the city, you kind of touched on it. I have 2 goals with the city. One, I want more young people to get involved that would never have thought to. I never thought I would do this. Like I'm hoping to be, for my community, the one that, hey, he did this? Okay, I could do this too. And we get more people involved. And then two, like I want to make our community a place that our youth doesn't want to leave. Like that's one scenario that we face right now. We don't have a lot to offer for the 18 to 40 year old. And my kids are going to get to that age. Like, you know, I'd love for my kids to stay into this community and raise their kids here and, you know, run that true like small town vibe. And so I'm hoping to make impact there as well.
Dude, I love that, man. I think everything you're doing is inspiring. And I know the people that, you know, come behind you or look up to you, I know you're doing a lot for them. So keep it up, man. And I appreciate you coming on the show, dude. I'm a huge fan and I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Listeners, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you in the next one. Peace.